Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to Radio Islam International, here live from the Durban studios, by myself, Mustafa Darsot, who is presenting today's chapter of the Big Picture Show on behalf of Brother A.B. Dawji. There's also a live feed on Radio Al-Ansar, courtesy of Radio Islam International. Okay, so it's been another eventful week in the world as well, this week. However, you know, as much as we've had so much happening around the world, there's been a lot happening in South Africa too. But just to touch on a few things, well, you must have heard about what's been happening in Britain. You've got a new Prime Minister who's in office, Brian Johnson, and he's already feeling the heat of his, you know, his grand plans that are not working his way, that he's already called for a snap election, you know, in October. However, he's been met with stiff resistance. Now, this all stems with the Brexit, which is obviously the term given to the referendum that was held by the UK a couple years ago, whereby they voted to leave the European Union for good because they saw no benefit in being part of the EU. And the reason for that referendum, or what fueled that referendum, was the right-wing political parties and support groups that basically said that we need to leave the EU, we cannot be part of the EU because of immigration. And that ties a lot off to, you know, what we have to do with the latter part of this first hour about what's been happening in South Africa this week, where we've had a xenophobic violence and basically this, you know, sudden call by South Africans to say that the immigrants must leave. But going elsewhere, well, Kashmir still has been a hot topic. There has been talks of the blockade being easing, or the lockdown, from the Indian government side, right? However, from the Kashmiri side, it's been, you know, nothing has really changed. The curfew is still in place. Movement of people is seriously restricted. Food and medicines are on a shortage. They said that they restored the landlines, but people can't get through. The mobile and internet is still down. Mobile communication and internet is still down. So really speaking, what do they mean when they say that we have eased the lockdown or the restrictions? This week, the 5th of September, marked exactly, that was 2 days ago, 1 month since this abrogation of the Articles 370 and 35A, and the lockdown began, and the people are under siege. As I've said in the previous shows, and, you know, pointed out to, you know, the grand plans of the Modi government, or should I say the BJP government, headed by Modi, that's controlled by the right-wing Zionist equivalent called the RSS. And RSS has, you know, close ties to the white supremacist groups around the world. So it's got everything to do with racism, hatred, you know, superiority of a particular class of people. And this is what they, I mean, Kashmir is a pride matter for them to say that, listen, we're contesting these upcoming elections, and it was in the election manifesto, and one of the things we're going to do is we're going to make sure that Kashmir, that Articles 370 and 35A had to be revoked in order for Kashmir to be part of India. In other words, a formal occupation Zionist Israeli style of Kashmir, and telling the whole world, go to hell. And you can see, although there's been outcries from certain leaders, to a very, mild kind of outcry, it's the attitude from the Modi government is that, you know, we're invincible. We did it, we got away, and you know what? We've got Russia supporting us, we've got the Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates supporting us. We got, you know, we know that we can count on Donald Trump when we need him. So, and we got Israel supporting us. So what? Who cares? And this is where it's where the situation stands at this moment in time. What you are seeing is that you are seeing a very vocal outcry from civil society, and not just Muslims. You are seeing, I'm seeing also, especially in the past couple of weeks, I've noticed, and this week particular, that Hindus in India, although we've seen, heard their voices from the beginning, but now are not being scared to speak out. You can understand if they were scared to speak out in the past for reasons of intimidation, for, you know, threats of violence against them. But at the end of the day, they are not scared to speak out. And they are writing articles in high-profile publications, be it the Washington Post, the New York Times, coming on to mainstream media to say that what's happening in India is wrong, what Modi is doing is wrong, what the BJP doing is wrong, and that at the end of the day, something needs to be done about this, and the world needs to come together and stop this. So the thing is that we can only hope for the better for, you know, out of this whole situation. Allah knows best how it's going to unfold. Honestly speaking, Imran Khan has given his stance as far as Pakistan is concerned, matter like a lonely voice in the dark. You've got China supporting him to an extent, but China has got its own dirty backyard as far as the treatment of the Uyghurs are concerned. And the only reason why China is supporting Pakistan on the matter of Kashmir is because China has got a territorial hold over parts of Kashmir, which it also annexed illegally. So you have that sort of situation. Moving elsewhere, in Hong Kong, this week has entered the 14th week of civil disobedience and civil protests against the government. The thing is that the people in Hong Kong function as they live under a democracy, although it's a city-state, right? But they live under a democracy with full equal rights under the law. And the problem is that China is trying to push the envelope by violating these rights, you know, as and when the need arises. And the thing is that there's a very important lesson to learn from this, and that's what brings us to the situation in South Africa, is that with the civil disobedience that you are seeing in Hong Kong, you are seeing very little or minimal violence. By and large, what you're seeing is peaceful. Whether it's the blockade of the airport, whether it's the blockade of the train stations, or bringing the city to a standstill, by and large, these protests have been peaceful. And then you ask the question, why can't it happen here in South Africa? We've been seeing for the past few years, and it's been growing every year, the people are fed up of service delivery, whether it's, you know, crime, whether it's, you know, issues of, the cost of living being too high, etc., unemployment. But whenever we have protests here in South Africa, it turns violent, it turns ugly, and it's really, really getting out of hand. Now, the thing is that South Africa witnessed on Monday very ugly scenes coming out of Johannesburg, whereby, and this was announced, you know, prior to Monday, whether it was social media, you had a bit of ad hoc reports in the media that there is going to be, you know, that we're going to act against the foreigners. We're going to take action against the foreigners, right? And Monday saw the most ugliest form of xenophobic attacks. And this is not the first time that xenophobic attacks have taken place in South Africa. It started back in 2008 when Thabo Mbeki was president. It recurred again a few years later, right? Especially in 2015, again in 2017, and now it's reared its ugly head again. And the thing is that what was very upsetting and hurtful is that the police were incapable of bringing the situation under control. And that to the government is to blame, because when this word was going out that they're going to act against the foreigners, in whatever way, right, that the government should have been proactive and said, right, make sure that the police were deployed to various areas where obviously foreigners are in a majority, whether they reside in there or whether they have their businesses there, bring in the army. We have an army here in South Africa that's doing more in parts of Africa than what they're supposed to be doing in this country when we have civil unrest, right? That could have stemmed the situation. Okay. It was areas of the southern western part of the city of Johannesburg, and a bit of the eastern part where you had areas affected like Turfontein, Germiston, you know, all these areas that are close to Jeppestown. And the thing is that they said they were reacting against foreigners, but even local businesses were harmed. Right? A Muslim family who owns a car dealership, 40 cars, a used car dealership, 40 cars that were on the stand, all burnt. Right? Then I heard last night there was a family that had that's got a store in a certain mall there in Germiston, right? That the thugs came through the roof of the mall, broke into the center, right? In the form of herd mentality, stole everything from the business, including the shelving. Right? Now, these are local businesses. What I'm saying is, I'm not saying that they should have only targeted foreigners. No. Whatever was happening was wrong. And the police were just there. They said, yes, we tried to stem the situation, but the violence was so out of hand that, you know, the thing is that it became shameful that, is this what South Africa has become? And it's not, and xenophobia is not unique to South Africa. We must know that. But the thing is, we must ask, why? Why is it happening? I spoke about last week about the fires in the Amazon, right? That these fires were taking place, but there's an origin to this situation, right? So the Amazon fires is a story, so is the current xenophobic violence a story, but there's every story has an origin. And to that origin, there's a background to that origin. Right? So when it comes to xenophobia, right, the origin of the story is whether people are, you know, anti-immigration or feel that, you know, this is exclusively for them, and, you know, it's whether there's, you know, they look at, you know, whether it's greed, or whether we say we just have a dislike, or we feel threatened that they are, you know, taking away our jobs and our, you know, what's meant for us, our livelihood, right? That's the origin of the xenophobic. But what's creating that? What's the background to that origin? Right? And the background stems from hate and basically a lack of education to understand that at the end of the day, whatever you want to achieve in life is what depends on you, what you're willing to put in and the effort that you're willing to put in. And only by putting in that effort can you achieve certain things. Now, in South Africa, unfortunately, we have radical leaders who will say, you know, the land is ours, you know, the white man has everything, they took everything away, and nothing is left for us, and 25 years into democracy, right? So obviously you're feeling that rage amongst people. And then when the foreigners get attacked, no, but these are our African brothers, you can't touch them, they're more than welcome to South Africa. And then also go and blame the white man for causing the current xenophobic violence. At the end of the day, what you can blame whoever you want to, what are we doing to make sure that this doesn't happen? It happened in Pretoria last week, when a group of taxi drivers went and confronted a certain drug den in the city, and alleging that this Nigerian was selling drugs, and the police were not doing anything about it, and then they decided to act, and the Nigerian shot back at one of the taxi guys, he died, and the next thing, the whole area went in flames. Okay, that happened last week. As we didn't learn enough, and then when the threats of acting against foreigners was coming up again, what happened? We weren't equipped enough resourcefully as far as manpower was concerned, whether it was the South African police, whether it was JMPD, Johannesburg Metropolitan Police, or the South African Army. In fact, the Army still has not been brought into to contain the situation. However, we fortunately that the situation has been contained to a certain extent. Right? We've had in the past for, areas like Forsberg, Mayfair were never affected, but this time the mobs turned their anger towards shops being looted, windows being busted, etc. I mean, why must this be happening in the first place? Right? So again, the origin is there, that people want, whether they feel that there's, you know, their livelihoods are at stake, or whether it's poverty, whether it's unemployment. But what's the background to this? And then you have to look at this, is the hate, and, you know, and not only hate, it's also the lack of the authorities to act, to make sure that, you know, things are carried out properly in the way, following the letter of the law, the rule of the law. So, I'll give you an example. If what happened in Pretoria last week with the so-called drug dealer, which the taxis were confronting, they kept on claiming that the police were doing nothing about it when they complained to the police. The fact remains is that, okay, you complain to the police were doing nothing because they're alleging that the police were taking bribes. Why are the police taking bribes? What's been done to stop this? You've got our borders that have been opened. That was a wish of Nelson Mandela before 1994 to say that we must open the borders to Africa. Fine. We can understand where Mandela was coming from on this, because he says when we were down in the height of apartheid, it was Africa that stood with us. And you saw the same message being it was announced this week by the head of the Somali traders in Johannesburg. It's been a little video clip that went viral, and he said, when South Africa was under apartheid, when the ANC needed help, when South Africans needed help, Africa stood by you. Whether it was Nigeria, whether it was Ethiopia, whether it was Somalia, Morocco, Libya, Tunisia, Africa stood by you. Now you turn against Africa. Right. So then the young generation will come and say, but hello, what was apartheid really all about? Because some people who are 25 years old were born in the year 1994 when we had our freedom, our elections, and they say, what was apartheid all about? So they don't understand. So they say, but you know what? Okay, that was your payback to Africa, but what you doing for us? And then you have this mentality and this mindset of culture that of entitlement. That's another background to this problem, that we feel that it's all for us, and it's all for us with no effort. If you do not work or make an effort to look for work, you're not going to get work. Right? You take a thing that's been going around, this building mafia, especially in the Durban area, but it's been happening in other parts of the country. They call it the construction mafia, the building mafia. I'm just giving you sidetracking, but although it's more related on local matters, right? They go to building sites. They see, you know, contractor working there with his team, they go and shut down the site. We shut it down the site, and they go there with threatening language and, you know, and in a bullying manner. And they say, right, because we want the jobs. What are you giving us? If you prepare to give us work, then we will let this job carry on. So then the contractor will ask, okay, what is it that you're capable of doing? Okay, we can do bricklaying, we can do plastering, we can do, you know, roofing, plumbing, name it. Next question asked to them, what is your rates? Right, they say they give a rate, which is three times more than what the current subcontractors are offering, who are running their own businesses as subcontractors and are making a living, and that's the going rate. But the thing is that you see, it's no, but we want the work. You must give us the work. But I'm giving Mr. Kumalo the work. He's a South African. He's self-empowered. He's my subcontractor. This is what I'm paying in. That's what the industry allows. Right? How can I pay you three times more? Then the next thing is maybe the flashing of a gun and the waving of a gun. The site is shut down. After a few months, then work carries on again. What happens at that time? That subcontractor, maybe he's got people working for him. They don't have any work at the moment, so the families are starving. Right? So this is the problem. This is what's the culture of entitlement, the, you know, hate and the corruption. Obviously, these are the backgrounds to what's been happening here as far as the xenophobic violence is concerned. And the thing is that it's not going to be the last situation. Until the government does not clamp down on this in the sense of being more effective with the policing, with all the security apparatus, it's going to carry on. This happened on Monday in Johannesburg. On Wednesday in Durban, shortly before 12 p.m., phone calls were going wild. WhatsApp messages were circulating that there's going to be big trouble in Durban against the foreigners. Okay? Like, my business is in the Durban CBD, right? I mean, people were panicking. I saw the panic whereby foreigners got word that there's a march in town, and obviously there was a bit of fake news attached to it, and that they're coming for them. What happens? People panic out of fear, close their shops. You know, staff that are working for, you know, of foreign origin that are working for certain employers, whether, you know, they all panic. They need to get home, and they're worried now they can't take public transport because they may be in that taxi, they may be attacked, or whatever the story is, right? And the thing is that, oh, but people say, but you know, it's, there was an overreaction. You cannot, you know, put it down to an overreaction. In the past, when the previous times when the violence happened, like for example, it happened in February, March 2015, which I recall very clearly, that when the foreigners, when the mob was in the Durban city coming to target the foreigners, and the foreigners decided to run for their lives, the trauma and fear that I saw on those people's faces, it's something that's still etched in my mind. So at the end of the day, when one says that, you know, there's an overreaction, no. Because at the end of the day, this is not an overreaction, this is a reality. You know, and we must make sure that as South Africans who are third, fourth, fifth, sixth generations of Indian origin or whatever, that we have been so far spared, you know, as far as the violence is concerned. And we must make dua to Allah Ta'ala that He protects us always and our communities always. But the thing is that it can, you know, the chances of it can happen and the tide can turn against us if the situation gets more out of hand is always there. Already you've heard many times anti-Indian sentiments, Islamophobic sentiments by those who are totally clueless as to what, you know, Islam and Muslims are about, right? You've seen that sort of thing already. So the thing is that it's, you know, there's always an attempt to light the match, right, or light the fuse. But the thing is, you know, while they're threatening to light the match, when will that match be lit? Or let's hope that they don't light the match, or let's stop that match from being lit. That's the reality that's facing us here in South Africa, and we have to learn from this. And you know, and of course, as civil society, we have a duty. We say that, okay, the government has to take action, the government needs to be proactive, yes. But as civil society, we need to ensure and make sure and push our way with government to act. Whether it means writing a letter, whether it means sending an email, whether it means being vociferous, etc. But you need to act as civil society to say that, listen, you know, human rights are at stake. These people are also, you know, have rights. They've come here, they've skipped, you know, the most brutal of civil wars, epidemics, famine, name it, etc., you know, violence. They've come here in search for survival. They're not necessarily came here for the good life. They came here for survival. And they're earning only to survive, to feed their families, and to send whatever they can back home for those that are not able to leave. Nobody wants to just leave their shores or the comfort of their home country and come to another country, you know. Nobody wants to do that. I mean, you take, for example, with Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe passed away yesterday, right, at the age of 95. Yes, he was a liberation hero. He spent 11 years in prison, right? He did his bit for freedom fighting for the people of Africa. But at the same time, right, greed set in. And okay, yes, he was justified in taking action against Britain or taking a stand against Britain. But the manner in which he did it was wrong. There was other ways of addressing the matter, but nevertheless, and he didn't want to backtrack, or should I say, didn't want to compromise. And what happened was that Zimbabwe's economy went down the doldrums. People had to flee Zimbabwe out of survival. Right? You've got over 2 million Zimbabweans that have left the country, that have gone in search for survival elsewhere. A lot of them are here in South Africa, some are in Botswana, Zambia, other neighboring countries. And they've all said that if tomorrow the situation improves back home, we will return to our home country. The same thing with the people from the DRC. I know a lot of them, they're from the DRC here, right? I know the Somali, like Somalia is always in a civil war between various tribes, right? There has been no proper functioning government for decades now. You speak to the Somali people, they said if tomorrow, by the will of Allah Ta'ala, and, you know, by effort from the international community, if the violence stops, we'll return back to Somalia. Anyway, that concludes this part of the xenophobic violence. When we return, we're going to talk about a more serious matter that has also gripped South Africa after the break. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the Big Picture for the second part of this program. My dear listeners, we're going to play a sound clip now of an announcement that was made yesterday at the Masjid al-Quds in Gatesville, Cape Town, by one of the trustees, Haji Abdul Sattar Parker. And it's a very important announcement. In fact, the video of this announcement has been going viral from last night. And I just felt that the message in this, it's a very important message that we should listen to. And we're going to play it, and then it's about 7 minutes plus. Please listen to it, and then, you know, we'll give our thoughts day after.
I now would like to proceed with the second part of the announcement, and I need to just give a word of caution that it is not the most comfortable announcement that you've heard in this masjid. It's a bit of a long announcement. Please bear with me. And it's been a week in our country when I think each and every South African should hang his head or her head in shame. I repeat, It's not a comfortable announcement, but certain things have to be said. You cannot just wipe them under the carpet. As Sheikh Abdul Rahman has mentioned, we heard the news on Wednesday that a father hanged four of his children in Durban this week. Also, and this is where the uncomfortability comes in, a young boy gets raped in a toilet in a masjid in Pietermaritzburg. Uncomfortable, Jamaat, uncomfortable, but it's happening. Do not go into denial. Then we had the xenophobic violence taking place in Johannesburg and Pretoria, and I'm still trying to understand, and I've discussed it with the Imam, what is this whole issue? Because 80% of the land in this country is not in the hands of black people. The best jobs in this country is not in the hands of black people. Yet this violence, unashamedly, has been black upon black. And it seems as if we have forgotten who gave us refuge and shelter and support when we were fighting against the white tyranny of this country. It was countries like Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and Nigeria that gave us all the support so that we could overthrow the tyranny of the white rule in this country. But it seems like today it's been forgotten. And what is even more forgotten sometimes is that our beloved Nabi Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam himself migrated. He had to flee Makkah to Medina. The only difference was that the people of Medina welcomed him with open arms. And last week on Thursday, when Sheikh Abdul Rahman and I entered this masjid for Maghrib, there was a bigger number of people than normal in this masjid. And upon inquiry, we discovered that not one, but two of our Bangladesh brothers' janaza was about to take place. These were people who left the shores of their homeland, came across the oceans to come and settle in a foreign country which they call Africa, South Africa. They come to Cape Town, and then they proceed to a small little place called Malmesbury, opening up a tuck shop, working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so that they could have a piece of bread for themselves. And I know many of them feed their families back home in Bangladesh. And a maniac comes and he pumps bullets into the bodies of these two people. These people, the Bangladesh community, we must not forget, are doing exactly what our forefathers did when they came here 100 years ago. They came for a better life. The only difference is that when our forefathers came, they came into a detested apartheid state. They are today coming into a gangster state. Wednesday night in Philippi, two metro police were killed. And in case you are wondering, Jamaat, what is that ping sound that's going on in this masjid today? There's nothing wrong with the equipment. There's everything wrong with the country. For every 29 seconds, a woman is raped in this country. And that ping is to remind our conscience. 8th of August, Megan Creamer, 30 years old. 22nd of August, Lynette Folschenk, her body chopped up. 30th of August, Leandre Jagels, on the same day, Jesse Hess, murdered together with her 85-year-old grandfather. On the 1st of September, I told you it's uncomfortable, Janika Mallow, 14 years old, from Hines Park. And then on the 2nd of September, the event that has shocked the entire world, 19-year-old UCT student, Yuinene Medwatiana. All this happens in the month of August, which is supposed to be a month dedicated to our beloved woman. Something has gone wrong, Jamaat. Something has gone seriously wrong. And today, from this masjid, we echo those words, enough is enough. our women and our children are living in fear. All this because men are the problem. Perverted men are the problem. And I hope not, but if there's a perverted man sitting in this Jamaat, shame be upon you. They must realize, these perverted men, that they don't own woman. Woman is not their property. It is not the object of lust. And please, don't hide behind that facade, that if a woman doesn't dress the way you think she should be dressing, or if she goes to work, or if she talks the way you feel she mustn't talk, you can use that as an excuse to do these things to her. All men must hang their heads in shame today because of what fellow perverted men are doing. The message from this masjid is very clear, supported by the imams. Stop raping our women. Stop murdering our women. Stop this femicide. If you really want to apply the rules of Sharia, this finger is not even allowed to touch the body of a woman that is a stranger to me. That is how strict the Sharia is in terms of the relationship between a man and a woman. A woman are too precious a gift that has been bestowed upon us by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And today we will be requesting Sheikh Ismail, when he leads the salah inshallah, in the second rakat, once again to recite the kunut, in that Almighty Allah must protect our women, protect our children, protect our nation, and save us from this tyranny that has befallen us. I've taken a little bit of time. I hope you do understand. Shukran. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh.